Hello, thank you for listening to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Neflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 33 of our Disney Honorable Mentions.
Yeah.
This week we'll be discussing 2009's The Princess and the Frog.
So what we're doing with these episodes is we want to talk about basically films that didn't make it onto the bracket for whatever reason. Some of these are ones that didn't make it on for good reason. Some of them we're going to try to figure out what happened, because some of them probably should have been on there.
So before we get too involved in our analysis, let's go ahead and go over a summary for those unfamiliar. Tiana, a young black woman in New Orleans, dreams of one day owning her own restaurant, and literally works night and day to achieve her goal. Then, just before Mardi Gras, Prince Naveen of Maldonia arrives in the city. Tiana's childhood friend Charlotte has always dreamed of being a princess and asks Tiana to help her woo the prince with Tiana's beignets, offering to pay the last bit Tiana needs for a down payment. Meanwhile, Naveen and his butler Lawrence are approached by a voodoo huckster, Dr. Facilier. Facilier offers to help Naveen since he has been cut off by his parents, saying he sees green in his future. The doctor also offers to help Lawrence switch places with Naveen, as Lawrence has been pushed around his whole life. With a handshake, Facilier takes Naveen's blood for a talisman to disguise Lawrence as the prince, while also transforming Naveen into a frog. Later, while Charlotte is dancing with who everyone thinks is Naveen, Tiana finds the real, now amphibian, prince. Naveen believes that a kiss will reverse the curse, and asks Tiana to do the deed. This backfires, however, and transforms Tiana into a frog as well. The two of them cause a ruckus at the party and escape into the bayou. The next day, after meeting a few new friends, Louis and Ray, they learn of a voodoo priestess, Mama Odie, who they hope can fix them. After traveling deep into the swamp to find her, Mama Odie says that a kiss from a princess will break the curse, and since her father is king of the Mardi Gras parade, Charlotte counts. At least until midnight. Tiana and Naveen travel back to the city, and while doing so, realize they have feelings for each other, but neither acts on them. Before getting back, Naveen is captured by Facilier's shadow minions without the others noticing, eventually leading to Tiana assuming the human Naveen on the parade float is the real one, and that he abandoned her. Ray realizes something is amiss and is able to rescue Naveen and steal the talisman. Facilier tries to take it back, but is eventually defeated, although Ray sacrifices himself in the process. Tiana and Naveen explain the situation to Charlotte, but the clock strikes 12 just before she can lift the curse. The couple accepts their circumstance as frogs, as long as they're able to remain together. They marry in the swamp, and as they kiss, the curse is broken, due to Tiana now being a princess because of their marriage. They return to the city, open up Tiana's restaurant, and live happily ever after. Interestingly, this is one of the very few Disney films that we have exact dates for. The newspaper that Charlotte's father holds up at the beginning of the film reads April 25th, 1926. So we know the exact days that this film takes place over. With that context, we can also figure out that Tiana's father is a veteran of World War I, and due to the Distinguished Service Medal that is hanging on his portrait, is probably why he's not around anymore.
Nice.
That's a weird place to say nice.
I mean, I didn't pick up on any of that, and I appreciate you doing the deep dive to figure out what was going on with that. That's a cool thing.
And well, there's nothing wrong with setting that during a very specific period of time. The way that the film whitewashes history to do so is not the greatest.
This is definitely a sort of happier timeline in New Orleans.
There's very, very little in the way of overt racism in the film. The most you can probably count is the way that we see Tiana's neighborhood as like this poor community that's filled with all people of color, and that juxtaposed with Charlotte and her father and the plantation that they live on. There's also specifically one line from one of the realtors when they are explaining to Tiana that, oh, someone outbid you. And Tiana's trying to explain,
you know how long it took me to save that money?
Exactly.
And one of them comments,
which is why a little woman of your background would have had her hands full trying to run a big business like that.
While I do appreciate those small nods to the systematic racism that Tiana would face in trying to open up a restaurant, it's not really apparent anywhere else. There's no segregation going on, as far as I can tell. There's white and black people who are both eating at Duke's Cafe, where Tiana works. I'm not very familiar with all the ins and outs of racism in 1920s New Orleans, but these things seem very out of place.
New Orleans always kind of had a cultural reputation of being somewhere where racial politics were constantly being explored and renegotiated all the time, but this doesn't seem presented as that.
It feels a lot like every time a white person tries to write about something that happens in this time period and kind of ignores most of the racism that would face these characters of color.
It almost feels like there's two forces where, like, one is trying to pull the film into unpacking issues of race in American history, whereas the other one is trying to not think about it and just tell a fairy tale story. It doesn't unpack things well, and it doesn't do a good job of not unpacking things.
Like, another nod that this film was trying to unpack some things, there's an argument that Lawrence and Dr. Facilier have after Facilier realizes that the frog Naveen has escaped from the jar that they were keeping him in. And Facilier's talking points about these fat cats that are keeping Lawrence and him down.
Aren't you tired of living on the margins while all those fat cats in their fancy cars don't give you so much as a sideways glance?
Yes.
Are really interesting because they're pretty much an exact reverse of what the capital class used on poor Southern whites to instigate the animosity towards people of color in the South.
On the one hand, I really like that Facilier has legitimate grievances. He has a relatively sympathetic outlook on life, even if his way of feeling about it is wrong. But also, he has kind of the most overt class consciousness in the film and is also very clearly a villain.
There's a lot to like about Facilier. The fact that he has some of these ideals, but he is framed as a villain and somewhat villainous for having those ideals is not the best. There's also really just the fact that he could be such a stronger villain, but he's removed for most of the film. He is there for the setup, and then he's there in the third act in the final confrontation, and maybe a few small scenes, but he barely feels like a main antagonist, which is really sad. He's a great villain.
He's constantly acting through proxies, whether Lawrence or his shadow minions. And while his shadow minions are a really great sub-antagonist, the design is absolutely fantastic, and I love the way that they interact with the world. Because he's staying in New Orleans, whereas the other characters are traveling up and down the bayou, there's no real personal connection between him and Tiana till the end. I don't think they even meet till the end, do they?
No, they don't.
Tiana does at one point yell at Naveen for messing with the shadow man, which implies that she knows who he is, but that's about it.
There's also the fact that due to the very compartmentalized information, Naveen and Tiana and the protagonists don't even know that Lawrence is parading around as Naveen in human form. And it feels really weird. They don't figure out until 3/4 of the way through the film, and it's at that point where Naveen has been captured for more of his blood and realizes Lawrence is working with Dr. Facilier. And then a scene later where Tiana sees the human Naveen on the parade float and thinks that she's been abandoned. And I get to have that point of betrayal that Tiana goes through. They need to keep that information secret. But I think that's one of the reasons that Facilier doesn't have any bearing on what's going on in the bayou. You may be able to chalk it up to, well, Mama Odie is protecting the bayou with her voodoo magic and all that sort of stuff, but the film never states that specifically.
Right. We do see her make short work of his shadow minions at one point, yeah. But they were also like 5 feet away from her house.
There's also the fact that because they don't let Facilier try and like send his minions into the bayou all that often, we're stuck with that really drawn out scene with the Cajun like frog hunters trying to catch Tiana and Naveen. And while there's some interesting animations and action scenes going on there, it doesn't do pretty much anything narratively.
You could cut that entire bit and then like redraw a few scenes and nothing would have changed.
That's another thing. The animation in this film is kind of all over the place. You have these musical sequences that are gorgeous. Friends on the Other Side and Almost There have these gorgeous art style shifts that are mind-blowing. You also have a lot of really interesting lighting going on during some of the other song sequences of the film. But all the things that are happening in between feel lackluster in comparison, and it really feels like they spent all of their budgets on all of these musical numbers and stretched it as thin as they possibly could for the in-between parts. I think for me, that's one of the reasons that the film feels just like a bunch of songs strung together as opposed to an actual animated film.
I'm not sure if I go that far, but I get where you're coming from as far as the animation being hit or miss with putting it where it counts, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to do a thing where sometimes the characters will interact with the environment and the environment will be halfway between the traditional flat cell animation and the more painterly background style, and they don't quite hit that really well.
Yeah.
Especially like if water is moving around too much, or I noticed some scenes with like the branches are trying to be like the 2D background while also still being 2D flat animation, and it doesn't work.
There is some reason behind this. In 2004, after Home on the Range, Disney decided that they weren't going to be doing 2D animation anymore, and they kind of closed everything down. Some things changed in 2006 when Disney finally acquired Pixar and John Lasseter came back into the picture and brought back Musker and Clemens, who directed this film. So they wanted to go back to this 2D style for Princess and the Frog. However, their 2D pipeline at the studio was gone, so they had to kind of start from scratch, and there were some issues and growing pains because of that, because their old animation software that they used for like digitizing all their work was outdated, so they had to move to a completely new system that people weren't as familiar with and all that sort of stuff. So I don't want to blame the animators too much. They were working in very unideal circumstances.
On a pretty sharp time crunch.
Because the film was first announced in 2006. There was some backlash around that that we'll get to later, and then released 3 years later.
Right. So you gotta assume the film was probably in the can within about 2 years. That's a pretty fast turnover time for a full feature-length animated picture.
Yeah.
That said, some of the character design are really fun. I'll admit that it's very noticeable that Tiana and Naveen, who are kind of these like good protagonists, have very naturalistic faces, whereas a lot of the lesser characters or antagonists have more caricature to them. And you kind of run into that whole like beauty equals goodness thing, but yeah.
That might have something to do with the art team deciding to go back to the style of Lady and the Tramp.
Interesting.
Where you have, you know, the protagonists and especially ladies humans who have well-proportioned faces, but a lot of the side characters, Aunt Sarah, Luigi, and Joe at the restaurant, Officer at the zoo, all very caricatured. Before I had read that, I actually probably would have pegged the style as more going for early Renaissance style, somewhere in around Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast era.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But Lady and the Tramp makes sense because it kind of has that same animals and humans thing going on.
Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and talk about that backlash when the film was first announced.
Sure.
So this was announced in 2006. When it was first announced, the title was The Frog Princess, and it was about a character named Maddie, as opposed to Tiana. Should also note that this is a year, or around about a year, after Hurricane Katrina. So doing a black narrative set in New Orleans and some of the choices they went with. Emotions were a little raw at the time. People were very upset that the character's name was Maddie, as it was very close to Mammy.
Ooh.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons that changed. She was also originally a chambermaid.
Of course.
So they changed her profession to waitress. And being a chambermaid, the connection to Charlotte would have made a lot more sense than it does in the final film.
Right.
I'm not saying that was a bad change. It was definitely a good one. But there are some artifacts of what the film was before that I don't think they smoothed over very well.
Yeah.
Disney was not in a great spot due to Hurricane Katrina and wanting to tell this story. And I kind of feel for them. But on the other hand, maybe you could have just shelved it.
Right. Like, I would honestly have loved to see this movie a few years down the line with, like, the Tangled Frozen art style.
Mm-hmm.
The water, the lights, it would have been so pretty. Both the chambermaid thing, the Maddie Mammy thing are definitely a aspect of the creators being so separate from the communities they're trying to tell stories about as not think of the problems, and that kind of being indicative of a lot of the film's awkward at best handling of race.
Yeah.
While we're on that awkward handling things, I appreciate them trying to use voodoo as a plot element and not making voodoo unilaterally bad, but from what I've read, the reaction to that has been largely negative because of the implication you're left with and the long history of voodoo as being a fantastical thing as opposed to a real thing.
There's also the fact that the good and evil counterparts for voodoo in this film are probably not equal. I mean, yes, on a power level, they probably are, or Mama Odie's a little bit more powerful, but Mama Odie's depicted as sort of incompetent and not all there, whereas Facilier is, well, not completely competent, as he kind of, he loses in the end and does not choose the people that he's working with very well. Most of his failures are not necessarily his own fault.
Right. And it still presents the spirits he's working with as greedy, duplicitous, evil, all that jazz, which is hashtag not great. And like, while Dr. Facilier 100% got a doctorate from a curse, he also is one of the only Disney villains to kill a named character. He's up there with like Scar, and that's about it. There's a part of me that respects that.
I really like Dr. Facilier as a character. I just wish he got more screen time. His name is also so good. In French, Facile translates to easy. So, like, he's Dr. Easy. He's the easy way out.
Mm-hmm.
I just love how well that personifies what he's all about and this huckster image that he has.
Right.
Another thing that I found really kind of gross is the way that the kiss haggling scenes between Tiana and Naveen play out. If Naveen weren't a frog, I don't think that scene would work.
Yeah.
Because it's very, very coercive. And the only reason I kind of don't put it there is because Tiana can literally throw him out the window and walk away and not have to deal with any consequences.
Right. She repeatedly hits him with a book.
Yeah.
You have a very strong arm, princess.
But if that scene happened between two humans, it'd be disgusting. Kind of along the same lines at the very end where we see Charlotte and Naveen's younger brother.
Oh, yeah, that. I don't like that.
Yeah, like, I know it's like, oh, haha, it's funny, but no, it's weird and gross. It's weird and gross in Twilight. It's weird and gross here.
Yeah. And it's kind of a pity because I actually kind of like the romance in this film.
Yeah, it's not a bad romance story, and the way the two characters grow into it feels very natural. I think it's solid. Naveen starts out in the dumpster.
Mm-hmm.
As far as respectable romantic interest, but he grows as a person.
There is one thing I do really appreciate about him. In his first scene when he's playing his ukulele, cutting a rug, he at one point like runs into Tiana, kind of plays the ukulele and makes eyes at her. She rolls her eyes and doesn't give him time of day. And he sort of shrugs and keeps going. I really appreciate that he doesn't take her rejection as anything more than, eh, I'll try it with someone else. That is a healthy thing that made me think, okay, yeah, this guy will probably be okay.
And then him giving his ukulele to the little boy on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, Naveen is shown to be kind of self-centered and egotistical, but not necessarily a bad person.
Right. Also, I remember seeing this in theaters, and when he has a whole line where it's like,
perfect! You finally got into the music. Do you get my joke? Because your head is, it's in the tuba.
Get me out!
The friend I was watching it with died laughing, and we had to bury her the next day.
One other noticeable low point for me, we've talked about some of the artifacts left over from reworking the film, and this kind of feels like one of them, but I'm not 100% sure. The realtors talk about someone outbidding Tiana on the building, and it never really comes up again or is mentioned. I know it's kind of this plot device so that, oh, she thought she was getting her restaurant, but now she's really not. But it seems weird that, like, that's the way they decided to go with it.
Like, there might have been some other character who was in a previous draft who was trying to bid against her who got cut from the story.
Exactly. Like, that's the only reason I can see for that being there. It'd be much easier to have some sort of other expense come up for Tiana that would do that. If you compare it to the opening sequence in Up, where Ellie and Carl are saving up to go to South America, but all these little things keep coming up and they have to dig into their savings to deal with it. I think that's a much better way to handle that than something, oh, well, someone outbid you and they can pay it all up front.
You can make an argument that that's not a thing they just decided they don't want to do business with a black woman.
it's a valid read, but the text does not lead you there.
Right. And the subtext barely leads you there. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, knowledge of history.
Yeah.
I also wonder if maybe the hunters were originally going to be more of a thing. They kind of show up and then leave and they don't really need to be there. So I don't know if they were, like, going to be working with a shadow man or something, or...
Yeah, like, there's a lot of weird stuff like that going on in this film, and it's rather unfortunate. I think if this would have had a little bit more time in the oven, it might have turned out better.
Right.
Well, now that we've kind of exhausted all of our issues with the film, let's talk about some of the awesome things about it.
Okay.
I love John Goodman. John Goodman is wonderful. Although part of me can not listen to him voicing this character and think...
Well, allow me to introduce myself. Name of Daniel Teague, known in these precincts as Big Dan Teague. All of those who are pressed for time, Big Dan!
What I'm saying is I want fan art of Charlotte's father with an eye patch.
There's a scene when Tiana's waitressing and Charlotte is talking about the prince coming to town.
Did you hear the news? Tell her. Oh, tell her, Big Daddy.
Oh, yeah, Prince Naveen.
Prince Naveen? Of Meldonia is coming to New Orleans. Oh, and he's a bee's knees. Ooh, tell her what you did, Big Daddy. Tell her.
Where he's trying to just eat his plate of beignets, but something keeps interrupting him every time, and his little small mutterings of protest are delightful to me.
What just happened?
On the same token, I love Charlotte, or Lottie. She's in that unlikable rich girl archetype that I immediately fall in love with. Cross-reference Cordelia Chase, Lydia Martin, Cheryl Blossom.
Normally, I would dislike Charlotte for that specific reason. However, it's shown that she actually really does care about Tiana.
Right, I love that scene at the end.
Like, that scene at the end, but also earlier at the party after the table falls over and Tiana's... gets all messy. She leaves Naveen, the person she is trying to woo and get to marry her, to make sure that Tiana's okay and get her into some clean clothes so she can actually enjoy the party.
Mm-hmm.
She is willing to step away from her dream, even though it's almost right in front of her. She can almost grasp it to make sure that her friend is okay. And she again does the same thing at the end of the film. So, like, she really does care about Tiana. From what it seems like in the film, she doesn't really understand the hardships that Tiana faces, but she tries.
Right. She could easily just buy that space for Tiana and fix up the restaurant for her with her dad's money, and it would be fine. I guess Tiana wouldn't want to ask because pride, working for your dream, all that jazz. Yeah,
but I mean, could also honestly just be an investment.
Right. Also, speaking of the scene where she helps Tiana get all cleaned up, she has that amazing bit that we really can't recreate on a podcast where she says,
"Well, back into the fray."
Shakes her decolletage and then walks away, and it's an amazing animation bit. This is, I'm not sure if it's a good or a bad thing, it's kind of a weird thing that I have a number of answers for. So this is 1926, but Lottie and Prince Naveen almost get married, and no one tries to stop them, including her dad, implying that it was like a thing they could just do. Interracial marriage was super illegal at this point.
Well, A, there's the fact that he's royalty.
Yes.
There's also the fact that while he has darker skin, Meldonia is not a real country.
Right.
It is based off of a portmanteau of the Maldives, which is Southeast Asia, and then Macedonia, which is like in between Italy and Greece, that sort of area. And then Naveen is a very common name in Sanskrit, so you're getting some Middle Eastern vibes there. And then the voice actor is from Brazil, and then kind of inflected in a more French tone to get that sort of accent. So it is completely unclear what sort of ethnic background Naveen and the country of Meldonia as a whole occupies.
You're right. And I will admit the either like different timeline or they just didn't want to think about it or they're rich so it doesn't matter thing. But there's another answer that is more interesting to me, and it's what I'm going to choose to believe for the fun of it. It is possible that Charlotte and possibly even her dad are not legally white. There is precedence, you see. And it's a precedent that involves voodoo as well. We have it on authority that either Marie Laveau, that Marie Laveau, or her daughter married a white man because that man injected his future bride's blood into his veins and then swore in the court that, yes, I have black blood in my veins. Therefore, was no longer legally white and therefore could marry the love of his life. There is precedent for that being possibly a thing. It's a little weird, but it is technically a possibility.
I mean, it goes down to the one drop rule that was on the books for a very long time.
Yes.
In very various places. But no, that is another well-reasoned argument that that is how that works.
Right.
So we're talking about the scene where Tiana's cleaning herself up, but right after that, where she's on the balcony and then meets Frog Naveen. I really love that scene because it mirrors the same scene at the beginning of the film when she's looking out her window and in her room. And it does this great job of letting you know, okay, we're back into the realm of fairy tale after we've been going through all this serious stuff of like finances and all that sort of thing. The way that scene is, like, even the scream is exactly right where it should be. It's very well done.
The comedy of their first interaction, all their interactions really, are very good.
Mm-hmm.
It helps that Prince Naveen is a very funny, witty character. Mm-hmm. And Tiana being his straight man is a really good bit.
Mm-hmm. Naveen is one of my favorite Disney leading men. He is very charming.
Yeah. Also, talking about good things, the music is excellent.
Yeah. The jazz inspiration for a lot of the songs is, like, just so on point. It fits the setting and the style of the film so well.
And I like how they have different variants, so you have that more Cajun flavor for the Firefly song. To be honest, I Want song is still very jazz inspired, while also kind of having that big bombastic Disney I Want song flavor.
Mm-hmm. And the art style shift to this Art Deco Harlem Renaissance inspired graphic work is so good. It's very appropriate for what they were doing.
And especially the way that it doesn't just snap from real world to Art Deco. Tiana's clearing away windows and letting sunlight come in, and then the rays of sunlight are in Art Deco, whereas the not illuminated bits aren't. And then it, you know, the Art Deco fills in, and it's a really, like, fun thing you can only do with animation.
Yeah. Throughout the entire song, Tiana still has more detail than all of the figures that she's interacting with, and that kind of is solidifying her as she is the only thing in here that's real. Everything else is kind of just her imagination, her dreams, what she's working towards, and it's still kind of blurry and unfocused because she's not there yet.
When we shift back to that during the climax, when Facilier is offering her everything, the stark shift down from this beautiful fantasy to her reality is a really visually satisfying shift.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of visually satisfying things, can we talk about the weird fetish play at Charlotte's party? The lady dressed in Little Bo Peep and her husband in a sheep fur suit who looks very upset about it.
I mean, I'm actually going to say historically accurate. I'm sure that happened a lot at rich white people parties.
That's fair, yeah. Also,
especially a masquerade ball where, like, no one knows exactly who you are.
That's true.
Right? Think about it. It's a fancy dress party. It's dark. You'll all be wearing masks. It's the perfect opportunity to commit murder and incest.
Also at the party is the octopus, or the guy dresses as an octopus, but all eight arms work. That made me laugh, and it just kept coming back.
When he, quote unquote, thinks he hears frogs talk, he dumps out all eight of his wine glasses.
It's very good.
There's also a guy at the party dressed as Zorro, and I had to look it up, but by 6 years, that is doable. Zorro was first published in 1919.
So that's topical for him.
Yes.
That'd be like someone dressing up as Deadpool right now.
Exactly.
Also, at the party, there's a really good bit where Tiana hears the dog, Stella, talking, and is surprised by this, and there's a very short conversation about it, and it's a really good setup for the idea that animals can talk to other animals, and humans can't understand what they're saying, and that will be important for the plot down the road. It's a good way to put that in advance for us. I appreciate that a little bit.
Yeah, I do think it worked out well there, but I think that might actually be another artifact when Stella was going to be a bigger character for trying to help them lift the curse, and it didn't work out that way.
I can see that.
It doesn't feel like something that the film would include for that reason.
Right.
Another weird thing like that, one of the alligators at the first night we're in the bayou where they're attacked right before they have to hide in the tree, one of the gators talks about how Naveen will taste great battered and fried. Yes, I'm sure that would be the case, but how are you, an alligator with no thumbs, going to accomplish said task? Especially when you're trying to, like, bite him in half.
I mean, the only logical solution is to assume that that alligator has a deep fat fryer lodged in its throat. We know from Peter Pan, crocodilians can have complex objects still lodged in their bodies that work. So There is precedent, Your Honor.
It could also be another holdover, because at one point, Lewis was actually a human who had been turned into an alligator.
Wow, there are so many plot elements in this film.
There are. This film is kind of all over the place.
This is actually kind of a low point that I forgot to mention. I think that Lewis and Ray are kind of a bit much, both in the characterization and in the plot. I think we could have reduced it to just one of them and been okay. Maybe have them already be a duo the way that Timon and Pumbaa are, as opposed to a character we meet and then another character we meet.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that the second act drags on so long, is because you have them and then you have all of trying to get to Mama Odie and all the things that happened there. We've got the gumbo scene where she's cooking in the pumpkin. You gotta keep that.
Yeah.
That's important. But the hunters you can get rid of. You can condense down Ray and Lewis and kind of merge that into one. Although it'd be kind of weird meeting Ray during the day, since he's a firefly. You don't get the right effect. That screws with your timetable.
I think I wouldn't mind having both of them if there was more time to flesh them out a little bit.
Yeah. I love the Cajun yat on Ray. The voice acting is great. However, Ray in the film is kind of the person who understands love the most. However, he is in love with an inanimate object, and that's not real love. It makes a lot of the narrative around Naveen and Tiana falling for each other and realizing that they need that companionship and love, it kind of taints it a little bit and makes it feel less real and less earned.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, to be fair, I guess Ray turns into a star when he dies, so I don't know. Fireflies are weird in this continuity, although I do like that it ties into the whole Lion King thing. That
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like, maybe they are really fireflies.
They got stuck up on that big bluish black thing. Big.
Yeah. I do like that now all three of their answers are canon from that movie. That was fun. I think it's weird, and there's a part of me that kind of likes it. I don't know. It's messy. While we're on the fireflies, I like a lot of the visual gags they do with them, like fireflies can leave neon light trails with their glow butts. I don't know, what do you call them?
I don't know. Ask my brother, he's the entomologist.
That's fair.
Speaking about some of the weirdness between the relationship between Tiana and Naveen, the movie does this thing where it has Naveen kind of parrot back things that Tiana's father said.
I did not notice that. Go on.
When he's eating the gumbo that she makes, she tells her that
you truly have a gift.
Like her father said when she made gumbo for him.
You do, our little girl got a gift.
And there's a few other instances of framing Naveen as a mirror to Tiana's father, and that's also very weird.
Yeah, I don't like that. On the one hand, her dad is portrayed as this paragon of virtue, you know, his absence is a great loss and all that jazz, mm-hmm. And so I guess it could be read into as Naveen getting closer to being a virtuous man.
On the other hand, no, we're going to give Tiana daddy issues.
Weird.
Yeah.
Speaking of parallels, I appreciate that both Tiana and Charlotte squish Naveen with a book.
I am Prince Naveen.
Is another thing that makes me like Charlotte that she's not wimpy.
Oh, another neat little thing. When Lewis is first talking about Mama Odie and describing her to Naveen and Tiana, there's a short little reference to Madame Mim from The Sword and the Stone.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, so he takes the moss and does it like hair and kind of like pulls as if he had pigtails and like pulls it to the side exactly how Madame Mim does.
Oh, nice, nice.
I'm like, I saw that reference. I appreciate that.
I understood that reference.
Probably one of like five people who got that.
Yeah. Speaking of references, they 100% steal the animation from The Swan Princess for them transforming back into humans at the end.
I'm pretty sure that the turtle that shows up a couple times in the film is like almost directly traced from the model of the turtle in The Swan Princess.
Which is weird. Swan Princess is one of the few Disney princess films that isn't actually made by Disney, despite being incredibly Disney princessy.
Yeah.
I don't know like what's going on with that, if that was just an homage to something that the animators liked when they were younger, or if it's like going, we're still around and you're and relevant and you're not.
Yeah. I don't know, but yeah, I definitely noticed that.
Yeah.
So I realized that I forgot to talk about something when we were talking about all the issues that this film has with race. Tiana is shown as industrious and hardworking. She's trying very hard to save up all the money that she needs for this restaurant. The way that they frame it, it's definitely virtuous for her to be doing this thing, but there's also lots of people who would argue that, well, systematic racism doesn't exist. It's just that all those people are lazy and they don't work hard enough, and that's why they can't get ahead. Mm-hmm. And I feel that this film is reinforcing that to some extent.
The idea that you have to work for your dreams and that you can't just wish on a star is a good deconstruction. Good job, Disney. Interesting that it had to happen with your first African-American Disney princess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, well, all these other princesses just kind of got there. And no, Tiana's got to work hard for it.
Mm-hmm. In the same way, oh, the Frog Prince, you haven't done that story. Good job making a story out of it. Unfortunate that you took your first black leading characters and made them
not black for most of the film.
Right. There's a lot of things with this movie that are one step forward, two step back thing, or would be fine if not for this historical context stuff.
Again, with how they frame Tiana's work ethic, the kind of arbiter of morality of Mama Odie for the film is essentially almost trying to get her, no, give up on the dream, or you'll be fine as a frog. And like, and specifically, no, you'll be fine as a frog. There's a nice handsome frog right there. Why don't you go marry him? Not only does it cheapen the romance, but it feels like, oh no, your main goal should definitely be to find a husband, not to have a career or have a dream. No, you should marry someone.
Right. The way it interacts with work ethic is messy, but I'm glad that she doesn't wind up giving up on it.
Yeah.
So when I went into this, I was like, oh man, Prince of the Frog. I love this movie. I'm so sad it didn't do better. Now that I've watched it, I'm like, okay, I understand why it maybe isn't as strong as I remember it. Normally, this is where we talk about which we think is stronger, but there's only one film this time. Instead, I guess we should unpack why this didn't make more money than it might have otherwise. I know part of it was that Avatar came out the next week, and that, you know, was a bit of a thing for a hot minute.
Yeah.
It informed a major character on Glee. That was his plot arc. He spoke Na'vi.
Watching the film, I think this is maybe the third time I've seen it. I definitely see all the flaws and just kind of how messy and to a certain extent haphazard it all is. And again, it's not entirely just the film is bad. There were things going on behind the scenes that led to it being that way. It's also at a time where Disney was not riding very high. I mean, 5 years before, they had decided, no, we're not going to do any more 2D animated films with Home on the Range. And then you have things like Chicken Little, Bolt, Meet the Robinsons. While some of those films are pretty decent, they're nothing to write home about. And I think part of that is why this film didn't do well. But I think that what hype that this Princess and the Frog was able to achieve is kind of what helped slingshot Disney into their revival that you could argue started here or started with Tangled.
Mm-hmm. While I understand why this film didn't break into the top 32, I definitely think, you know, I would rank it within the top 32 of the Disney animated.
Oh yeah, that's definitely better than a lot of the older Disney fare that we watched, even if it does have some of the same issues with race, although to a much lesser degree.
Right.
As messy as this film is, it's still better than things like Pinocchio and The Christmas Carol that we watched.
Right.
Like, its pacing and other issues aren't that atrocious.
Right. There's parts I'm like, we could probably just lose this, but I would rewatch this again. Like, if someone's like, hey, we're putting this on, I'm like, cool. Whereas if someone's like, hey, we're putting Jim Carrey's A Christmas Carol on, I'm like, okay, I need, and I cannot stress this thoroughly enough, to go cut my hands off instead.
No one should watch that movie. It's bad.
It's very bad. Speaking of movies that are good and bad, what's up next week?
We have our first honorable mention double feature. We will be discussing Disney's Robin Hood, as well as Sword in the Stone, doing a sort of British mythology double feature. Thank you for listening. If you have enjoyed what you've heard, make sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Podbean, or Spotify, whatever your preferred listening platform is. And until then, we hope you tune in next week. This has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast.